Hey everybody, JJ Cooper, Jeff Ponce here, another Baseball America Prospect podcast. And let's tell you, this one's going to be kind of the one for us podcast where Jeff and I like to talk pitching a lot. That's something that we both kind of have several things in common, but we both love to just kind of think about pitching, talk to people about pitching, analyze pitching, watch a lot of pitching. So today we're going to talk about pitching and we're going to get geeky with it. We're not going to just stick with this is a fastball and this is what a changeup looks like. No, we want to talk about kind of one of the things we want to talk about today are, well, at least that I want to talk about. I'll let Jeff kind of talk about his part that he wants to talk about. But for me, I want to talk about things that I used to think were true and have come to realize that are not true. And there are other things that I thought were not true and maybe they are true. To give an example that we're not going to dive into, but I started Baseball America in 2002, and for the first 10 years I was at Baseball America, it was pretty much a hard and fast rule. There are a lot of things that you could do in pitching, but you couldn't change arm actions. Changing arm actions could basically be described as you giving someone an artificial heart, right? Where, okay, if the patient is basically dead on the table, maybe we'll do it, but the risks of it are so severe that it's just not worth doing otherwise. And then Lucas Giolito and some others showed up and were like, hey, I'm completely changing my arm action. And it helped them take off as pitchers, become much better pitchers than they were. And before long, we're like, oh, not something you want to do all the time, but changing arm actions, how long you are in the back. Some pitchers went from really long to basically almost barely just bow and arrowing it. That or changing release points, which is something that we see kind of more often now, those things are changed. Those are not what we're going to dive into today, but those are examples of kind of some of the things that we've learned and that we've heard from a lot of very smart people in baseball and that we kind of wanted to share today. So great to see you, Jeff. I know that you have been before we dive in, like this will be down the road coming at baseballamerica.com. I'm sure we'll talk about it on the podcast too, but share what you've been doing, speaking of pitching, over the last few days.
Yeah, so I was on vacation last week. So I did take some time off. I watched mostly major league games instead of minor league games, which was kind of refreshing, honestly. Much better defense and you know, it's that time of year where I feel like big inning is really great because, you know, you can watch a lot of young pitchers that have come up over the last couple of weeks, you know, making their second, third, fourth starts, guys like Nolan McClain, Peyton Tolley, even Jacob Mizorowski, who's, you know, sort of no longer a prospect, but obviously, is always an exciting watch and, you know, still somebody that up until very recently was on our lists. But I, in my free time and, you know, when I had time to kind of kick around, I did sort of dig in and kind of dig in deep on a lot of different pitchers. Most of the guys that I've looked at so far are like top 100 guys, but my hope is over the next couple of weeks to kind of maybe look at the top, say like 50 or 60 or so starting pitching prospects that we have in our top 30s that are still in the minors. I removed all the draftees because there's not really a whole lot that I can evaluate on those guys. A few of them are pitching, but I don't think Liam Doyle over a couple of starts in Springfield is really going to tell me a whole lot that I didn't already know. You know, how those guys show up next year is going to be a big deal. So, you know, kind of dug in on those guys, stayed away from some of the guys that have made major league debuts, some of the hurt guys. And there's a lot of guys in our top 100 pitching wise that have either pitched in the big leagues, were recent draftees, or are hurt. So it's kind of interesting going through some of those top names and even some of the guys like just outside the list. So I kind of like just like to dig in. And when you have some time right now, we have this sort of month where, you know, we hate to say it, but it's kind of a dead period a little bit for minor league baseball where there's playoffs, but some seasons are winding down. Right now you have a lot of guys who like their year is pretty much over. We do have AFL coming up in a month, but most of the focus now, I think when it comes to baseball fandom is really focused on the major leagues, focused on the playoffs and maybe a couple of these playoff series and, you know, some of the higher levels still wrapping up. So it's a great time to maybe dig in deep on pitching or something you may want to spend a little extra time on. And we have all these resources available, and a lot of these numbers are kind of final now. So you can, you know, take them beyond just like a small sample size that, you know, most of the stuff that you're looking at is normalized, and you can even maybe even pick out trends that happen throughout a season. So with all the video, all the data, all the information we have available, I kind of figured why not take this time and dig in some pitching and have some more formulated, informed opinions on all these guys.
So what we're going to do, we're going to let this conversation kind of take it where it wants to take it, but we do have some topics, some kind of starting points we have. And a lot of those are going to be things that we're going to start with, kind of things that we've either discovered through the years, learned through the years, or in some cases, things that we thought we knew. And like I said, I brought up, you know, arm actions for one, but that's where I wanted to kind of start with this, which is, I want to start by saying, like, if you follow me on social media, you probably have picked up that I do believe that velocity is important. Like, I know that there is a subset of baseball fans out there who really wish it wasn't true. They would love to think, you know, or hope that it could be something where pitchers could pitch and they wouldn't need to throw hard and that you could do the craft of pitching and all that. But physics are physics. And I know that there are hitters who say that they can catch up to premium velocity, and they can, especially if your bat's really fast. But throwing harder is harder to hit than throwing softer. It's the way it's always been. But with that, when I started Baseball America, the idea was you either had velocity or you didn't. And not that you wouldn't see natural maturation. It's not something where you said if a pitcher was through 88 as a 18-year-old, that same pitcher was going to throw 88 as a 25-year-old. But with that pitcher through 92 as a 25-year-old, that would be viewed as the pitcher filled out, as he got stronger, he would add velocity naturally. I think really you get to about 2010 or so, and you start to get to the point where weighted ball research, kind of some of the shoulder strengthening that was started with being done not to add velocity, but to reduce shoulder injuries, which it did a good job of, like these targeted strengthening exercises to improve the strength of the muscles surrounding, you know, that the shoulder, the muscles there, to ensure that you would not have the weakness in the shoulder that would lead to rotator cuff injuries, shoulder injuries, and things that really have been devastating to pitchers, which we are not completely out of the woods on shoulder injuries, but we'd see far fewer shoulder injuries than we did kind of in the early 2000s. Go back and look at, I've got the handbooks there. If you look at the Reds list from anywhere from like 2001, 2, 3, 4, and you could almost like just go to any pitcher on there, and it's like, what happened to him? His career was derailed by shoulder injury. Chris Grueller, you know, being the Ty Howington. I could just go down a list of them. Like, it used to be a real problem and it kind of gone away. But Jeff, like, we're now in the era where I would say we very much have seen that if you're a pitcher who throws strikes and you're, you know, you want to be a pro pitcher and you're 91, 92, 93, right, as a right-hander, let's say, and you can spin it a little bit, you can locate all that. The biggest thing that you have to do now is, hey, I'm going to have to figure out how to add velocity. And we've seen over and over, we have a better idea of, the industry as a whole has a better idea of how to improve mechanics to generate that velocity and how to train to generate that velocity. Like, that's something where nowadays, I think that if it used to be when I started at BA, there was belief that velocity was something that you either were born with or not. Now velocity is very much, I would say that there is a carrying capacity that different pitchers have. You know, if your body's not strong enough, you may exceed the red line for your arm. And again, we don't want to say that there are not injury risks involved with throwing harder, because throwing harder adds stress, especially right there to the pitching elbow ligament. However, I don't think there's even a question nowadays about that anyone really debates the fact that teams, organizations, training facilities have, you know, have learned how to help pitchers increase velocity.
Yeah, I think, you know, the results have played out this way, particularly over the last 6 to 7 years now, because I think even five is probably, you know, too recent for when this really took shape. But I think we even see certain organizations now too, where, you know, they get their hands on a particular pitcher, and very clearly, I think across the industry, we get feedback like, Peyton Tolley's the kind of guy who's going to add velocity. He's got this big body. He's very physical. He moves very well. There's just some mechanical stuff to clean up. And, you know, I think even beyond sort of the stuff that's discussed publicly, like, you know, they used to call it the gas camp or whatever it was, but the off-season Mariners camp where they all added velocity.
Where it seemed like that you went there and you came out the other side of the assembly line with an extra 3 miles an hour.
Yeah. But I think even beyond that, it's not just, it's like eat good food, lift big weight, get strong. It's like, not even that. It's like, it's much more complicated than that, in the sense that these biomechanical markers and certain sort of, you know, trunk positioning, things that are beyond my comprehension, because I've never worked with athletes on a one-on-one basis, you know, that weren't little league pitchers. So like, it's like, I don't have a concept of like even how advanced it is, beyond knowing the things that when you get into conversations with the people who are, you know, hands in the clay, boots on the ground, that's the sort of stuff that they have access to and they work with, and they recognize and are able to make those tweaks that then show up in another couple inches of ride, or maybe more velocity, or better deception, right? It's all those sort of things. And I think you touched on it well when you talked about like arm angle being one, or, you know, even, you know, your action, your slot, or shortening up. And we've seen Lucas Giolito sort of found another gear in his career, going from a longer arm action, more moderate, to a very small one. And, you know, we see different examples of all these little tweaks throughout, you know, the operation. It could be grips. It could be how the arm moves. It could be the legs or the trunk, and just even posture could be a big part of it. So there's all these things that can tweak other little elements. And I think the other part of it that we have now that maybe we didn't is, it's not just having an understanding or recognizing all the elements that matter for a successful pitcher, but having the ability to have some sort of benchmarks or markers to sort of evaluate those characteristics from, which I think is very different from even what we did have even 5 years ago. Because more and more of that information becomes prevalent, more people that were in these spaces and in these conversations behind closed doors with organizations then become public or share that information with the public. And we have a lot more high level discussions about pitching than we used to.
We are longtime fans of Omaha Steaks, and I am drooling looking at the website right now, featuring USDA certified tender steaks, and also during their Red Hot Sale event going on right now this fall, 50% off site wide at omahasteaks.com, plus for the FT fam, an extra $35 off with promo code FOUL at checkout. You've been a big fan of Omaha Steaks since your early days as a pro.
Brings me back to my A-ball, low A-ball days, because we used to survive on this. We get a big order at the beginning of the year, cook them on our little electric grill, can of peas, some mac and cheese. That was dinner for four. We survived off Omaha Steaks. It still has a special place in my heart.
You thrived. Well, you guys ate like kings.
Yeah.
That's special. Get fired up for fall grilling with Omaha Steaks. Visit omahasteaks.com for 50% off site-wide during their Red Hot Sale event. And for an extra $35 off, promo code FOUL at checkout. 50% off at omahasteaks.com and an extra $35 off with promo code FOUL at checkout. See site for details. Dig in.
I would also say with that, like, to give an example, like you talk about mechanics. I can't remember the first time that I heard the words lead leg block, you know, which is to try to simplify and dumb it down, is when we talk about this, it's like the chain of energy, you know, Driveline was talking about, you know, started with kind of hacking the kinetic chain. They were one of the groups that was kind of studying this, but you're trying to get your energy all into your arm at the right point. And that doesn't just involve your arm. It involves your legs. It involves your trunk, your torso, everything all leading up to it. And part of that is kind of throwing into resistance in some ways. It's something where it's not something where you just think about being just free and easy. Like there are parts of legal ad blocking was something that I think, you know, Dr. Marshall was kind of in some way looking at 40 years ago. Like this was things where people are kind of working on things, but we've got a much better, or we, the industry has a much bigger understanding of them now than it used to, and allows the, you know, teams to do these kind of things. And that is going to get me onto a little bit of a digression and a rant that I'm sorry, Jeff, you've heard me time and time again, but I'm just going to share it with everyone else because I still get people and they're citing my story to me. They're telling me that the velocity hasn't improved. Velocity hasn't changed. It's just that the radar guns are different now. And then they'll say, see, here's the story, which is a story that I wrote. And they're telling me that I'm just an idiot because I don't understand this. And let me just say, let me just try to clarify this. If you talk about the suitcase radar guns of 1978 to 1982 that a few scouts had, not many, but a few scouts had them. And I'm talking the suitcase was the battery for it because you couldn't fit a battery to the radar gun in anything smaller than a suitcase. These are the, this is when the radar gun for baseball was less than a decade old, right? If you brought one of those to a game, yes, it kind of registered it at the plate. And so if you said, how does that compare to Hawkeye now? 7 to 8 miles an hour, maybe. But here's the thing with those. Those guns didn't say that guys were throwing, well, for one, anyone telling this, fine. Like, as someone who loves to go through archives of old Baseball America issues and other baseball content, I've got the scouting notebooks from the 80s down there. One thing that stands out about that, for one, is if you talk about velocity in the early 80s, often it doesn't exist. You don't have a record of it. I'm not saying that there's not maybe sometimes a record on a scouting report, but you get to the early 80s, there was still debates among scouts about whether you needed a radar gun or not. The new scouts were like, radar gun's good. And the old scouts were like, you don't need a radar gun. I've been using my eyes for 40 years. Why do I need to change? And the reason why you need to change is that it's helpful to be able to measure it, because you may say that this is, he throws hard, and another scout says he throws hard. And you're both right, but that guy throws 3 miles an hour harder than you're hard because he's in a different part of the country. That's different than just being able to say he throws hard, being able to say he throws 94 or 88 or whatever. But at that time, you don't see a whole lot of velocity reads. There are many prospect reports from Baseball America in the early 80s that says he has a good fastball. That is the extent of the information about the fastball, right? But you will see sometimes in their report that says he throws 86 miles an hour on the slow gun. And if you saw that on the slow gun, okay, that could be 92, 93 miles an hour on Hawkeye, which we can call a fast gun. That's not what people are talking about, though. They're saying that the pitchers who threw in the late 90s, in the 2000s, in the 2010s, they threw as hard as they do now. It's just being measured differently now. No. Stalker has been the main radar gun since the mid-90s. The Stalker ones came out in the 90s. I found Baseball America ads from like 1993 advertising Stalker Pro ones, right? They weren't even Pro ones back then. They were the Stalker Pros. Stalker Pro 2s came out in the early 2000s, okay? That's been the radar gun. A Stalker 1 from 1998, 1995. One, if you want to be crazy, you could say 2 miles an hour different from Hawkeye. Jeff, I will ask you, because I was going to say, I've used the same, and the radar gun technology, I know they have Stalker 3s now, but they're the same. They have some other additional factors, but when I'm using a radar gun at the game, it is the same Stalker 2 that I have been using for 15 years, and no one is using some newfangled radar gun that is different than that sitting in the stands. They're all using those. And I'm talking literally the same radar gun that I was using 15 years ago, and we're seeing 100 miles an hour all the time now, and I never saw it. And when people tell me, oh, no, it's just because the velocity measurement is different now, I'm measuring the same way that I was measuring 15 years ago when I was driving all around the country trying to find 100 miles an hour in person and see it for the first time. And now I see it all the time. I will stop ranting and just see if you have any thoughts before we move.
Yeah. On. I mean, I've had a Stalker Pro 2 Plus, so I don't have the S, I don't have the spin gun, but it's the one that I think the only difference is it can like transfer like wirelessly information, which I've never used. But
right.
I bought that gun in 2019 and I got my first 100 in Worcester in 2021. I got 99s. And I had been to the Fall League. I had seen the Cape for a couple of years with that gun. I had gone to minor league games in Pawtucket and Lowell and Portland and New Hampshire and Hartford, seen all types of games. And then I really started to consistently get 100s probably in like spring training of 2022. I got a lot more just even on like random backfield games. And then started seeing it way more consistently, you know, in season games in 2022. I probably saw three or four or five guys that hit 100 miles an hour. Like I look back on it in that gun, and the gun runs probably a little slow, like versus Trackman or Hawkeye, it will be like a mile, mile and a half, sometimes two. But there's also the human error in terms of like my arm and like where I'm actually pointing it versus Hawkeye, which is consistently picking it up at the right spot all the time. So there's more accuracy to it too. So I think that might be part of it. But I've seen guys just over the last 3 or 4 years seem to throw a lot harder. It's way more common now as someone who went to minor league games my whole life. And probably saw a radar gun for at least the last 10, right? Like at least in terms of the board or whatever. It's way more common now to just see a random guy come out of the bullpen that throws 100 miles an hour. Like if you sit in a series in any double A park, there's a good chance there might be a couple of guys that throw 100 miles an hour. And some of them aren't just relievers. Some of them are starters. Like you can see, you know, Carlos LaGrange, and he throws 100 miles an hour all the time. You could see Harlan Susana. He throws 100 miles all the time. Brody Hopkins can hit 100 miles an hour. Andrew Painter can hit 100 miles an hour. Bubba Chandler can hit 100. Jacob Mizurowski can hit 100. Chase Burns can hit 100. Peyton Tolley isn't at 100.
That's not normal.
Touched 98 as a lefty in his MLB debut. You know, Brandon Sproat, another guy that's hit 100 miles an hour. There are so many starters who hit 100 now. And I think that's even more of a case for this because you might see the off reliever. You might see Pat Light hit 100 miles an hour, which I think is the first time I ever saw someone in person throw 100. I didn't have a radar gun. It was up on the board and in Pawtucket. Like I see that all the time now from guys that start. That have movement and command. That's the other part of it, you know?
I would say that there are, on average, 10 pitchers per organization now in the minors, not the majors, but in the minors in a given year who are 99 plus, who can touch 99 plus. Like your average organization has 10 of those.
Yeah.
And I would say it used to be like, I do not look up, a reliever comes in, and they like their first pitch is 97, 98. Now it's just like, that is just what we're seeing. I remember 2010, 2011 being at A ball games. If a reliever came in and they threw 97, I was stopping what I was doing to pay attention because that was like, I would not see that again for weeks. And now I knew that that was a dude. Like if you threw 97 like that, you were a dude. Now you are just one of many.
I think like that's still the case when I'm on the Cape. I think it's one of the fun things about being there is there's still like a level of finding stuff, maybe not against the industry because all those guys obviously have been found enough to go to the Cape. But you know, you get a guy from a small school that comes out and hits a 97 or a 98 or a sitting 95, 96, then that's like kind of exciting. And you're like, wow, this might be something. It's a little more rare there. But yeah, I mean, if I'm in double A and a guy hits 100, it's like, yeah, but like, what's his release characteristics like? Like, does he have a secondary? How frequently does he land it in the zone? And, you know, I think that's a big part of it. Like I was looking at Carlos LaGrange today, as someone asked about him in the weekly hot sheet chat. And it was like, do you think he's a reliever? And I said, it depends who you talk to, because some people internally might think he falls on the reliever side. I tend to feel like he's more of a starter. You look at the body, how many innings he's thrown. And then you dig into the actual zone rates, because we have in zone rates for all these different pitches over, you know, all the games leading up to the beginning of September. He has an above average zone rate in his fastball, on his breaking balls. It's really only the changeup, and that's very fringy. And most changeups tend to have a sub 40% zone rate. So I tend to look at a guy like that or a guy like Harlan Suzan and say, there aren't many guys that can hold this kind of stuff and throw this many strikes with that big of stuff. You know, so it's crazy because now we have starters that do this in the minors, where, you know, if we had maybe one or two guys who did that in the majors 5 or 6 years ago, that was a big deal. Now it feels like we have prospects. We have guys that might sit 100 in college next year, you know, with Jack Bauer making it to campus, right? Like, that's a strong possibility next year. We have Paul Skeens, right? I mean, there's just so many guys that sit 100 miles an hour that just seemed completely impossible back in the early 90s when it was Roger Clemens and, you know, David Cone and some of those guys who were the hardest throwers in the game.
Okay. I knew this would end up being longer than we planned, but that one went longer than we planned. That's probably because I get a little ranty about this, but this is now, I want us to get to a point that Jeff has made that I think is an interesting one. And this one, if you thought that was a little geeky, buckle up, because this one's really geeky. And we're going to do that right after this quick break.
Hiring the right people fast keeps your team moving forward without losing momentum. Every day a position stays open is a day you're missing productivity, creativity, and growth. When it comes to hiring, Indeed is all you need. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. Indeed Sponsored Jobs helps you stand out and hire fast. With Sponsored Jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates so you can reach the people you want faster. And it makes a huge difference. According to Indeed data, Sponsored Jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. One thing I love about Indeed is that it makes hiring so fast because it allows you to rapidly sort through candidates based on your preferences. Plus, with Indeed Sponsored Jobs, there are no monthly subscriptions, no long-term contracts, and you only pay for results. How fast is Indeed? In the minute I've been talking to you, 23 hires were made on Indeed, according to Indeed data worldwide. There's no need to wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. Listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/baseballamerica. Just go to Indeed.com/baseballamerica right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/baseballamerica. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring, Indeed is all you need.
And we're back. So, Jeff, one of the things that you've talked about, when we talk about fastball changeup interactions, you've kind of come to a realization on that, I think, in some ways, and talking to people about it, the realization that they have as well. So take it away.
Yeah. You know, I think when we look at changeups, it's different than other pitches. And it's one of the reasons that stuff models almost don't matter on changeups. And I know they've tried to make some adjustments for things like this, but the numbers never totally jive. And I think it's because it's a pitch that rarely sort of stands on its own. That's not to say that there aren't changeups in history, like, you know, Devin Williams when, you know, his airbender was at its peak, or, you know, Trevor Hoffman's changeup and some of these
Doug other Jones.
Yeah, that can stand on their own. There's certainly some of those. you know, and I think Roki Sasaki's probably listening to this and saying, yes, the only way I can be successful is if my splitter can stand on its own. But, you know, I think we too often kind of don't pay attention to how it plays off of the fastball. And the biggest thing, I think, even more than velocity separation, which was always something that historically we kind of picked up on and harped on. As soon as we had radar guns on television broadcasts, we could watch Johan Santana and say, wow, it's 11 miles per hour or whatever it is on average, separation between that fastball and the changeup. But I think more so than even that, while that velocity can certainly help if it's sold and, you know, it comes out of the similar slot, it's the separation between the ride on the fastball and the plane that that creates, and then the lack of ride on a changeup and the plane that that creates. And especially if it's coming out of the hand the same way, they often look like the same sort of pitch. And then, you know, at whatever point it sort of deviates and breaks, but, you know, just even the movement can look very similar. And it's just a matter of it sort of bottoming out kind of late. If you typically look at changeups, you know, it's not killing lift like immediately out of the hand. And so I think that's really, really important to sort of look at. And there was an article at, you know, years ago at Prospects Live with, you know, a bunch of guys that now work for teams kind of describing tunneling. And a big part of that conversation was sort of how the VAAs play it against each other. You know, between four-seam fastballs and changeups. And I think you tend to see, like, when I look at which changeups miss the most bats in the minor leagues, they tend to have at minimum a 2-degree separation between the VAA, which is the plane on the four-seam fastball, and then the VAA, the plane on the changeup. If it's 2.5 to 3, those tend to really, really play. And I think a perfect example this year was like Jonah Tong. The difference in his VAA on his four-seam fastball, which gets a lot of ride, and then on his changeup, once he changed his grip, that really played against each other because, you know, he sort of doesn't generate a whole ton of, like, arm side run on either his four-seam, you know, or on the changeup, but being able to sort of stretch that vertical break out of a sort of a similar hand position and release point allowed it to really play. And I think that's ultimately a big part of what deception is beyond how well you hide the ball. I think, you know, if you can watch sort of the path of the ball and how well it travels, it may not matter how much separation you have on two different pitches, just because the eyes of professional hitters and their ability to pick up on those sort of things and really follow that ball and time it. By the point they get to the big leagues or they get to the upper minors, they have so much experience of doing that throughout their entire lives. So it's really important, you know, part of it is deception.
Could I offer like a slight tweak to that? I agree with you, but I would also say with that, I see how those two are very interrelated as well though, right? Which is what you're trying to do, as we've talked about before on the pod, I think, and we talk about visual chunking, like the hitter is extrapolating where he believes the ball will end up, because he's seen pitches like this before. And the more that you are unlike what the batter has seen before, the better you're going to do. When you talk about ride, and then you talk about, you know, the separation, the vertical separation of the changeup, what we're really kind of saying with that is the batter is expecting the fastball to be lower than it ends up being. So the fastball gets above his bat, and the changeup is getting up lower than he thinks, so it's getting below the bat, whether that means weak contact or missing the bat. But I would also say, if you throw into that the velocity separation as well, that component. So now I'm managing to mess with the hitter in two different ways at the same time, right? Which is, I'm messing, like you said, there are hitters who are really good at this with timing. But if I, the more confusion I can create, the better. So if I'm managing to both create confusion as far as where the intercept point is going to be, high or low, and I'm able to create confusion, which I think that this, when we talk about stuff models and all, one of the things I've never gotten around to writing, and I should have, but now we're having these kind of bat path tracking and all this. If you think of, you can't think of all this in a two-dimensional plane. You have to think about it in a three-dimensional world, because I can be at the exact perfect location to put the sweet spot on the bat, at exactly where the pitch is going to cross the plate. But if I'm a couple of hundredths of second early or late with that, I've also created a problem. That's where the velocity separation, the velocity deception, I guess would say even more than separation. Because like you said, if you're telegraphing it out of the hand, it doesn't matter if it's 12 miles an hour, if you can read it right out of the hand. But if it looks like a fastball out of the hand, then that can add to the confusion of it. Which leads, I think, into our next point, that's kind of a shared one that we love to talk about, which is, you've talked about, there's a lot to me that's really good to me about stuff models, but I would say that I'll throw it out to you and see what you think. Stuff models, they're trying to get more advanced about this, but if you look at any pitch in and think of it in a silo by itself, you're not getting the full effect of a pitcher's arsenal. And I'd say that on the team side, we're kind of reverse engineering this, that we can see more and more on the team side that teams are more and more focused on arsenals for a pitcher. And really now adding more pitches to a pitcher's basically toolbox and saying that the interrelation between those pitches is often more important than the characteristics or the quality of any one pitch.
Yeah. And I think, you know, how pitches play together, you know, Robbie Snelling, who I talked about earlier, is kind of a perfect example, really close sort of release heights on all of his pitches. You know, the ability to play the game of sort of going east to west and north to south when needed. And, you know, everything that he does kind of plays really well together. So there might be other pitchers who have better individual pitches, more stuff, more velocity, more movement. And like in a vacuum, each one of those pitches could grade out better. But in terms of how it all fits together, how it's sold, how it comes out of the hand, the consistency of like your arm angle and release point, and, you know, do you drop down when you throw your slider or this, and like all that stuff really matters in terms of results. And I think we see that sort of materialize in not just like whiff rates and swing rates, but also chase rates. Like how frequently can you get somebody to, you know, expand the zone when you just miss, or you throw into that shadow area, or, you know, maybe even just throw it kind of out of the zone. I mean, we see some very ugly swings against really good pitches once we get up to the majors. You know, and it's not just Francisco Alvarez apparently unable to identify anything out of the hand like he did last night. But, you know, we see some ugly swings. I mean, Pitching Ninja made an entire career out of sort of breaking down those swings just in the major leagues. And, you know, it's kind of funny because I think a lot of the time that we see professional hitters look really stupid, it's because of a variety of things that happened before it, you know, how the first two or three pitches of a particular at bat might play out, or even previous at bats against this guy and sort of what the looks are. Yeah, I think it's, you know, there's so many little elements to all this stuff that, you know, how a pitcher kind of manipulates, lands, commands all of his different pitches within his arsenal and uses them situationally, you know, drive a lot of the results. It's not just like throwing hard and getting ride and doing all these things. It's like setting guys up in particular zones, knowing where to attack certain hitters, how to attack certain hitters. And I also think like when we're looking at pitching prospects, that tends to be the final finishing step that we'll see in AAA, where there tends to be more advanced scouting reports, more preparation, more information, and that goes on both sides. And then we often see that take another step forward in the big leagues. And I think it's why, you know, some guys that maybe have 50 grade stuff perform better as starters when they get all these extra tools and pieces of information, because they can adapt and they have that pitchability element and like, you know, are a little more cerebral about how they approach the day-to-day, you know, than some guy who has 60 or 70 stuff, right? there's a lot of starters who were ranked not as highly and didn't have the sort of blow you away stuff that Michael Kopech had in the minors, have found a lot more success as starters. So I think we just consistently see that. And I think it's one of the things that makes breaking down pitching so interesting is all these guys are enigmas and really they can kind of, they're almost like gas where like they kind of like don't ever have a set shape. You know, it's always kind of fluid to an extent.
An organization that really that kind of jumps out to me is the Astros, organization that you cover for us, but like the number of starters for the Astros who have six different pitches. And again, you can get into pitch classification. When I say six, normally often they'll have a sweeper, a slider, and a cutter. But a lot of times those are three distinct pitches for them and a, you know, four seamer and a sinker and a changeup, or sometimes there'll be a curveball and a slider and a sweeper. Like if you have six pitches, part of what you are trying to do, if you're doing that to your starters largely across your organization, like if I go back with the Astros, if you say, what did the Astros do really well in the late 20 teens, you know, back then, I would say that, okay, one, they really developed velocity. They had that was an organization. I was doing the Astros back then for us. And like the number of guys you'd ride up with, when he signed, he threw 87. Now he's 96, you know, like they had a number of those guys. But on top of that, it was something where you kind of knew that they almost, and we're seeing this, Detroit does this. I think the Tigers do this pretty well too, but like pitchers who they're this pitcher against a left-handed batter and they're this pitcher against a right-handed batter. And they have, it's a whole idea of making sure that you have plenty of weapons to handle either side hitters. And so you're not just the same guy. Like, okay, I throw my slider against I'm a right-hander and I throw my slider to get right-handers out. And then a lefty gets to the plate and you go, okay, I really don't have a whole lot of approach here. That the Astros at the time were going to be ones like, no, you have a curveball you throw to them. You have a changeup you throw to them. You have a fastball. And you may never throw that curveball. You know, it's a pretty platoon neutral pitch, but sometimes it'd be like, you're mainly throwing that against when you don't have the platoon advantage. They were arsenals. How these pitches all interplay is really important. That leads, though, again, when we talk about how these things interplay, another one of yours, Jeff, which is when we talk about extension can be really important and it can be absolutely unimportant. Is that a way to summarize kind of how you've kind of come to the point?
I think it's always important, but there's certain guys who can operate successfully without a lot of extension. But I think generally the guys who have outlier extension, they all tend to be pretty good in some way, shape, or form. And I think it's always kind of been the selling point in a guy like Peyton Tolley that, you know, he has this outlier extension and that allows the fastball to play up and the velocity and everything else will sort of come along with it. You know, it's not too often that you see guys that are sort of outlier on that particular end that, don't have some level of success. Like, and I think that you also can look at a lot of pitchers. Like, I think one in particular is like Chase Dolander, who's, you know, had some struggles this year. Obviously, his landing spot with the Rockies is certainly not the easiest of places. But the one concern that I had is he had sort of below average extension. And I don't know how much that's maybe played into him not having enough deception and being able to consistently create that outlier plane that he needs to succeed. So, yeah, I don't want to say that it's, I feel like it's more important now than I think I thought 3 or 4 years ago. But there are certainly starters who have success without having like outlier extension, but guys who don't have enough extension, it does become a little bit of a concern. And I think like Josh Norris had a great article today where he spoke with Thomas White last week and White called out his lack of extension. And when I broke down White recently, that was one of the few concerns I had with White was he doesn't generate as much extension as you would hope. And there's other guys like Andrew Painter who generate zero extension. And you're like, this might be kind of an issue and kind of why his fastball doesn't play the way we hope it would.
Okay. Now let me get even further geeky. When a pitcher doesn't have extension, why do you think that is?
I think it's just the operation. I think it's just, you know, I don't know if, I think there's a fair amount of athleticism.
That's where I was going to go. I was going to go to athleticism. It kind of tells me a little bit about the athlete.
Yeah. Cause I think like you look at some of the great athletes, like Brody Hopkins has pretty good extension. He doesn't have outlier extension though. But it's not below average. I think those guys tend to move a little bit better, get down the mound a little bit more. And you know, I think there's certain guys who are maybe moderate athletes like Gage Jump, where it's kind of just their superpower that they just do a really good job of getting down the mound, even if they're maybe smaller, more diminutive guys. But I do think it helps everything sort of play up. And I think it's a key component more of a really successful four-seam fastball pitcher. You know, if you maybe have less extension and you're a two-seam guy that can really make it dance east to west, like with your breaking ball and your changeup, I think those guys can also be really successful. I just think more often than not, those guys, you know, need to have some variation of like out generating characteristics of like, they can get grounders, pop-ups with certain pitches, and get the whiffs when they need them.
Hey, if you're wondering, like Jacob Mizorowski, extension king. Peyton Tolley, who you just mentioned, extension king. Bishop Letson, if you're looking for a pitcher who's further away, extension king. Those are guys who really do get down the mound. Now, I mean, again, like part of this also is, you know, it being 6'8", like if you're, you know, if you're a Mizorowski type.
Extension is relative to height too. Right. Like 6'3", 6'4" is really good for 5'11", 6 foot gauge jump. Right. Yes. You know, Jonah Tong, I think, is maybe 6'5", 6'6". Jonah Tong is probably 5'10". I don't know what he might be listed at 6'1". You saw him at the prospect pad. He's not taller than
a big dude.
And no one's ever listed me at 6'2". So, you know, I think like all of that stuff is really relative to height too, which is why like, yeah, Tolley is 6'6". Tolley also creates 7.5 feet of extension on average. So it's like, it's all relative. If you're getting above a foot from what your height is, that's really outlier.
Right. Anyone who's over 7 foot, unless you are, you better be, if you're not Randy Johnson size, you're getting over 7 feet of extension, is probably because you're getting really good extension. But well, that leads to the final myth, which again, I end up on velocity a lot. I know, but one that I think blows people's minds when I tell them this. A lot of people seem to think they think of velocity in pitching as kind of like it's something that comes with its trade-offs. And it does. We talked about the risk of injury. The risk of injury is real. If you want to be perfectly healthy, throw 80. If you throw 80 miles an hour, you'll probably never blow out your elbow. You won't be employed in professional baseball, but you will be able to throw to your kids and be safe and do that for the rest of your life. If you throw 100, the risk is going to go way up, but you also have a much better chance of being employed by a professional team and compensated very highly to throw a baseball. But the other trade-off that often is seen, and again, I get where this comes from. There is a kernel of truth here, which is if you throw harder, you also lose the ability to throw strikes. If you want to throw strikes, I don't want to see you throwing 100. I want to see you throw 90. And that's not true. And I say that that's not true. Now, there is a truth to if you have a max effort delivery where you're head whacking, you know, you're staring, you know, at the ground when you're pulling your arm through and you're into a really stiff front side and you are really long, like you're doing everything, you know, like you're grunting as you throw it to the plate. Then you may have more trouble repeating that delivery pitch after pitch, especially if you're asked to go 100 pitches rather than 20. I'm not saying that's not true. That's a scouting axiom that's, I think, got a lot of validity to it. But we also know there are a whole lot of pitchers who they get stronger and they throw harder. But you know what also comes with that? Because they're stronger, they're better able to maintain their mechanics even as they throw harder. And I say that because the strike percentage in the major leagues has gone up by 2% in the 21st century At the start of the 21st century, major league pitchers threw strikes 62% of the time. Now it's up right around 64%. It was below 62% some of those years. Now it's about around 64%. And I know someone's going to say, because I've had people tell me, oh, that's just because these hitters nowadays, they swing at anything. And so it's just on these, you know, they're getting more swinging strikes. No, the number of, if you track from 2007, we have the location of every major league pitch, basically, from 2007 to present. And if you look at the location of pitches in 2007, 8, 9, 10, there were more bad misses far from the strike zone, non-competitive pitches, than there are now. There were fewer pitchers on the edges of the zone than there are now. Pitchers are throwing the ball in the zone more and around the zone more than they did, even as we go back to my previous rant, even as they throw harder. But the thing I would say with that is, though, is that there's another component to that, which is the harder you throw, and this is where I'll kind of kick it to you for your thoughts, Jeff. The harder you throw, the easier it is to be in the zone. Because when I've watched pitchers over the years, we can all try to romanticize the idea of the soft tossing lefty who throws 88, who is right just painting the black pitch after pitch. A lot of times, though, you can't be in the zone if you throw that kind of velocity because you know you'll get hit. Whereas if you throw 100, you can be in the zone and you have a chance to generate swings and misses.
Yeah, I think a great example is a guy like Braden Davis from the Cardinals, who's been a pretty decent mover for them this year. A guy that was, I think, at Sam Houston State, then ended up at Oklahoma his last year, and then the Cardinals drafted him, had a good summer on the Cape with Falmouth a handful of years ago. And, you know, for him, it's funny because he's the kind of guy where I would put a higher grade on command, being the ability to land his pitches to good locations where he's going to be the most successful, like with purpose and intent. Like, I think that's kind of what command is, where control is just simply like, does he throw strikes? Does he throw enough strikes? Right. And I think like that's the, at least in my opinion, that's the defining characteristic is between the two terms. And, you know, a guy like Davis sits 89, 90, 91, 92. It's a little bit harder now. But he's always sort of had to live above the zone and steal strikes early and then sort of throw above the zone. But he has a very small sort of hot zone, kind of in that shadow zone and at the very top of the zone where his four-seam fastball is going to be most effective. And it's the same with his breaking ball. It's not super hard, doesn't have a ton of crazy movement, but there's sort of a window glove side where it's most effective. And that's whether he's throwing it to, you know, lefties or throwing it to righties, et cetera. And it's then a really, really good changeup. And like everything plays off of that. But those two other pitches, you know, if one was a 90 mile an hour slider and the other was a 97 mile per hour four-seam fastball, he wouldn't have to land at those areas. He could more or less throw it center cut and tell guys to just try to come and hit it. And, you know, even if he didn't necessarily have, you know, particular command of like where that's going to land, as long as it's in the zone or around the zone, if he's throwing that hard with a lot of movement, that's going to be an effective pitch. And so I think when you have this conversation of like guys who throw harder, more often than not, have a lot more leeway within the zone to still be successful, where there's other guys where, you know, the Kyle Hendricks's, et cetera, they have to be a little bit more tricky than Paul Skenes has to be.
I would say with that, when we talk about the injury risk with these pitchers who throw really hard, there's a truth to that. There's a risk with the guys who don't throw hard. Some of these craftsmen who are great at pitching, right? But you mentioned Kyle Hendricks, and Kyle Hendricks has had a great career. But as much as we can talk about the injury risk, you know, for a pitcher who throws 102, there's also this kind of similar risk for these soft tossers where the margin that you have, like you just hit it, they're on a tightrope in a lot of ways, right? If you're a pitcher like that, and all of a sudden your location, your ability to command the pitch just takes a little bit of a step back, and all of a sudden you start catching the plate a little bit more of that baseball than you want to, you can get hit really hard. Or Aaron Nola, who's got a good start last night when we're recording this, but like Aaron Nola has been one of the better pitchers in the National League over the last, decade now. He's been really bad for most of this year. And when you say like, he's still locating, I mean, I wrote a story earlier this year, like he is painting the very edges of the zone. He very rarely leaves a pitch center cut right in the middle of the zone here, tee off on it. But he lost like a mile and a half of velocity off of his pitches. And that just kind of took him from the right side of that, where it's like if he was 92, 93, and he was dotting right at the edge, that was working. And then all of a sudden when it became 90, 91, trying to dot at that edge, it was like hitters were like, yep, I got time. I'm going to hit it. Like you said, if you are sitting there at 98, your margin of error is I missed my spot with that pitch. But because you were aiming, like Aroldis Chapman, there was a story earlier this year that said that this is the first year that Aroldis Chapman, like, had a conversation with the catcher. And was like, the catcher was like, you know, aim small, miss small. And it's like, oh, I'm going to now, at 37, 38 years old, I'm going to try to hit your glove rather than just try to hit the strike zone. And kind of seemed to unlock something new for Aroldis Chapman. But Aroldis Chapman did that as year 16, I believe, in the majors, 15, 16 in the majors. And he's been really good all this time. Why? If you throw 104 and you miss your spot and you end up kind of middle of the zone, no one's like, hey, this is a cookie that I'm just going to crush. It's still 103. It's 104. So we could do this for hours, really, but we're going to try to limit it to an hour. So we're going to slide over into our prospect soapboxes, which is something that we do every week on this show where we talk about a non-top 100 prospect. We want to make sure top 100 is updated. You can check that out over at baseballamerica.com. But we also like to talk about prospects outside of the top 100. And Jeff, you've got a good one because you've, like I said, you've been diving deep on pitchers so far in the last couple of weeks on your quote vacation last week. So, because we look at baseball on our vacations too because we love baseball. But so, Jeff, who do you have as this week's prospects of Bucks?
Yeah, we're going to talk about a friend of BA, Brody Hopkins, as he's done multiple hot sheet shows this year, was at the prospect pad hanging out for a little bit. We've talked with him quite a bit. Was one of my favorite pitchers kind of coming out of Winthrop in the draft a few years ago. Ended up with the Mariners, which I thought was a great spot. Ends up getting dealt to the Rays in the Randy Arozarena deal at the 2024 deadline. And, he's really expanded sort of who he is as a pitcher during his time with the Rays. And, he's throwing a couple of different slider shapes now, worked in a different changeup grip that's been fairly effective. But I think when you look at this guy at the end of the day, it's four seam fastball at the top of the zone. The ability to ride it from a really low slot and release point, he creates really outlier plane. It's under a four degree VAA, which is kind of in line with what makes Jacob deGrom's fastball so unique. Kind of falls in line with that. He throws really hard as well. The command is still coming along, and I think the mechanics as well. He's fairly new to full-time pitching. This is only kind of his second full season as a full-time pitcher after being a two-way guy for most of his career in college. And I think, the big thing with him is his outlier curveball. It's a pitch with not a crazy amount of drop, but a crazy amount of drop for how hard he throws it. He averages like 87 to 88 miles an hour on a curveball, and there's just not a lot of guys in baseball that can do that. It's a really, really good pitch. It's really good in every single kind of metric. He commands it better than any of his other secondaries as well. Gets a lot of chase swings, gets a lot of whiffs. That and his fastball are key to his arsenal. But I look at a guy like him who's had some success, who is this incredible athlete, has all these really interesting attributes. And I think, over the next 2 years, if he takes incremental steps with his command and his control, and I think that will ultimately sort of pay dividends in terms of how much better the slider plays, how much better the sweeper that he throws plays, even how much better the changeup plays. And then he'll have this really well-rounded arsenal. And, he's the kind of guy where the results don't scream 560 pitches, but I think when you look at the total picture, it really does. So he has maybe a higher range of outcomes. You know, there's a larger variance there than there are with maybe some of the other pitching prospects that are ranked in the top 100 and guys that are ranked ahead of him. But I do think that he maybe has more of a chance to be like a frontline, like a number two type of starter than a lot of guys who are ranked ahead of him. He just maybe has less of a chance of being a mid rotation starter because of some of the things that still need to get cleaned up. But there's still all this sort of untapped potential and ability there. And I think it's one of the reasons that the Rays have kind of slow rolled him this year beyond just the depth that they've had in Durham. Because he is the kind of prospect that regardless of major league depth you might have available, you'll make space for a guy like that if need be. So I think he'll probably spend most of the year next year in Durham, and we maybe don't see like a full major league season from Brody Hopkins until 2027. But, you know, if things kind of bake correctly over the next year plus and he has a good offseason and it kind of hones in the mechanics and the consistency of his operation, I think that, you know, he could take a major step forward and be one of the top 50 pitching prospects in the game next year.
That's a good one. I'm going to go with one. I believe I haven't done this. I know I've talked about him before at some point, but I don't think he's been a prospect soapbox, which is a guy that I've kind of dove into a little bit more lately. I'm trying to mix it up and make sure I don't always just do, guys from organizations that I do. So I'm going to go into the Mets today, which is, if you check out the season that Jacob Reimer has had this year, it's really the best way I can put it is it's kind of impeccable. Like it really is one where you just say there's just not a lot not to like about it. I think a bat first profile, largely, you know, again, like a lot of these guys that we're talking about who are really good hitters, but he makes good swing decisions. We talked about this on the podcast recently. That's where maybe he came up a little bit, but he makes good swing decisions. He hits the ball hard. He doesn't chase out of the zone, and he has the components to drive the ball and create impact when he does. That's what you're looking for in a hitter. I just bring him up because I feel like it's been a really good year for the Mets. I've been talking to people, you know, I know Josh put out his DSL list last week and, you know, reading people saying like how we just don't really ever care about Mets prospects because, and that's why Elian Pena, you know, ranked lower on that DSL list, which I promise you that's not it. Like, I would say that like we're, you know, I think that we think that the Mets are doing really good things in the minor leagues, but we also are going to reflect the reporting we're getting, which is when you talk to scouts who covered the DSL, they were not blown away with Elian Pena, but Jacob Reimer is one of those guys in that organization that's had a lot of guys take a step forward. Carson Benj, obviously on the hitting side, being a bigger example of this. But when Benj left, Reimer kind of stepped in and has really done a good job for them at the AA level. I just think that the Mets, like, we're working on a piece coming up of like kind of looking at the trends of all the 30 organizations, because for as far as the prospect side, I think that the Mets kind of, I would say the Marlins are probably one that probably jumped out the most as far as having making the most strides. But like, I do see signs at the minor league level that the Mets are kind of building that prospect. I don't want to say superpower, but the ground floor is laid now for what you would expect for a David Stearns led team, where you would say, oh, they have a lot of money to spend at the big league level. But on top of that, they're really going to do a good job at player development. And I mean, obviously, it's kind of easy to say that right now, Jeff, isn't it? When we talk about their pitching, when we talk about that, I feel like that they're having auditions to see, is it going to be, if they make the playoffs, which we assume still they will, I feel comfortable we can say that they're going to have at least one rookie in their rotation come postseason, but maybe two. And if you could be three, I mean, like, I don't know if the team's ever done that, like, or the last time that's happened, but I would say that at this point, Nolan McLean is in their postseason rotation. I can't imagine he won't be in the rotation. Jonah Tong might be in the rotation, and we'll see on Brandon Sproat. He's got a couple more starts here to kind of show it, but I would say like that's an example, but again, they're doing good things on the hitting side as well. So a lot there to like with what the Mets are doing this year. Even if, you know, we clearly hate the Mets because we have Elian Pena not ranked in the top 10 of the DSL top 35. Yeah. You know, But that's the way to wrap it up here at the Baseball America Prospect Podcast, as we do every week. For Jeff, I'm JJ. So long, everybody.